This is Terry Gibson, Eros and Alchemy, October 21st, 1995, tape one of...
He quotes that. Every time he did it, he popped the cap. And somebody said, what is that, pop the cap, somebody's ass. That's what he did every time. He's turning the story. He goes, turn the story.
Cinematographically, too, he is the center of the action. It all focuses on him. And Travolta is off on the side and just sort of deflects. And trajectory, you know, ballistically tries to decentralize it. The gravity still is right there with him sitting and everybody else standing looking down.
See, the camp's water line, and the gravity is there, but the transformation is happening all around him. And you see another key cell phone, another key.
I think it's
absolutely. We never know what's in it, but every time it opens, the same thing happens. All during the film. What happened? It's awe, and what else do we notice? It's gold. It glows. And what happens to when an innocent looks at it, what happens? Trance, and he says an interesting thing. He uses a description.
Beautiful.
It's beautiful. It is beautiful. Not a voice there. What's he seeing in the audio?
Metaphorical.
I think he's seeing the empty bones, the self, the golden heart of fire. He's seeing himself as a shepherd. He's seeing all of his angels and archangels and instruments. He's seeing the way up the ladder through all the darkness and the divine one. She's waiting for him. I've seen all of that. The case goes through all this murder. That is the goal. The case through all this slaughter, through all the film. Get the case back to the boss man.
Did he go right through that he said, "Hey, it's not mine"?
Yes, one's boss. Of course, in his new theology, I think he's going to start rethinking which boss he's really been thinking about, who he's been caring for.
We'll talk a bit about that. Well, I just want to skip tracks a little bit because that line again is beautiful like that. Just so it was expressed, I remember that I was there to the Lost Ark. The very end, the Nazi drunk husband's the artist. It's beautiful.
It's beautiful.
Same.
And it is the philosopher's gold. It is the essence. It is the essence under existence. At that moment, the kid stopped existing and anxious, distracted, and fallen away. And for a moment, he was, first moment, and the only moment in the whole film, he's absolutely congruent and genuine. He's as genuine as the young servant girl last night putting the shard up next to her. Paul had an identification of that too. I think it is like the Nazi desires to break the laws of his bad experience and like life breathe. We know the self is in the picture, but somehow the mystery is inside that cave.
I thought I saw a similar theme with the lunch that provided the $1,500. There's something more than just a matter. It was all of a sudden transformed into something more than just the paper.
Yeah, there was the goal of compassion in that and realization of. And there was also kind of an initiatory quality about the just you're saying, but there was a. My guess is that that son never had a father that really initiated him, took him to a foggy river bottom and watched the surface come. That kid never had an experience, and it was a little bit of fatherly eros, self-claimed and self-embraced initiatory experience, and that kid was given a gift that he hadn't earned. The things that we got earned. What was the earning for?
Giving him his
life. And what was his life? What kind of life was he supposed to claim?
It had to be reflected. Here we have verse and, chapter and verse of scripture. I'm giving this to you. Now you go off. Here's your koan. You go off in the corner and think about it for the rest of your life.
Birth of reflection. Really want to do it. In all of the Greek, a lot of the great Greeks mess and alchemy, one of the greatest gifts given. Reflection. The ability to not be anxious and scanning, suddenly reflect. Where do we see another image of reflection?
When it, as he looks into the case.
At the case, it's reflecting. It is the birth of the reflective capacity. That's what heals. That's you can't be an alchemist unless you can see the beauty in reflection. You can look in the retort of your own life and see the beauty there and think and be moved and contemplative. I think to get the way you've got to earn it. So here are the problems. Self-based things. I want you now, son, to be conscious.
awake and alive and vital, go into the world and reflect on what you do.
A very kind of biblical sense. Go and sin no more.
There's also the redemptive notion of the child having to reach into the garbage bag, a black garbage bag, and redeem his father's wallet and his father's money.
And the bad motherfucker part of fathers. Right? I mean, that's, every daughter has to do that for her mother, and I think every son has to do that for his father. Has to redeem. I never thought about that, but I think my dad and his thing bicycling is hoping that he's redeeming, and somehow his two sons are redeeming the bad motherfucker. He believes that about himself. I don't know the point is my dad went to a lot of church and were confessional last 10 years and pain with men silent carry the patriarchy about the badness of themselves, the darkness, and the guilt about it. Never thought about it. That's wonderful. Out of the garbage bag to redeem the badness.
And it's 10 talents.
Yeah.
I will give my sons, this one gets 10, this one gets 5, this, you know. What do you do with the 10 talents that your father gives you?
And the jealous brother somewhere says, I'm going to pop that. None of this prodigal son cried here. What are you doing? It's $1,500. He goes, he gets upset. That's mine here. What are you doing? We earned that. We went through a lot of holiday. You start saying
this. Well, I was thinking that too. He was getting into this, taking out of the garbage bag an identity that he gave him. It was his, but... and also the metaphorical theme of the case with the gold, that there were only glimpses of it, and then closed up, that carried with him.
Yeah, I agree, because it said bad motherfucker on his wallet, and that's his identity. He was giving back his identity, and he was given by another guy's life.
And what part of his identity was it in a Jungian model, do you think? Was it a deep core identity, or what part of that
persona?
It's a persona identity that I think he was beginning to think about.
Yeah.
I'm trying really hard to shed a persona. That worked for a while, but I need to be the bad motherfucker. There might be something forming me on this.
Yeah, that very act, I mean, people are saying this, but it's an alchemical moment where from the bad motherfucker, he's taking out the goal, he's taking out the word from that.
From the Negrito. Where is the Negrito? The shadow? And of course, what's related to, what is persona's companion in Jungian psychology? They are brother and sister. They are twins. What is always connected to the persona?
Shadow.
The shadow. The shadow and the persona work together. The persona masks the shadow. And they are companions. They are the two Janus guns. They're part of the seamless whole. And there is this, the Negrito stage is looking at the shadow that's always behind the persona. We have to strip and get naked. And I think it is getting under there, getting into the blood. That's the Negrito stage. Where is their rubedo? Where is their passion in this act? First of all, where's mortifacio? If there's putrefacio and mortifacio, there's this death. Where's death? It all begins, death precedes birth. Where's death in this?
Time blink away
in this scene, and it's death is all along. They're carrying this corpse around.
Yeah.
That's caput mortua. It is the dead head. The guy's head was literally blown. This corpse, they spend the whole movie kind of cleaning up. And I think this guy's suddenly saying, I've been spending my whole life with death. Mm-hmm. Mortifacio and putrefacio, and it's not transforming. I've been in the Negrito day in and day out. And of course, what is Quentin Tarantino really? And his tongue-in-cheek, and yet his place is surprisingly touching. What is Quentin Tarantino, what is this a fable about? And why has this film become a cult classic, and why has it grabbed your life? I think it is the fall, it is Quentin Tarantino's Gnostic description of a fallen world we're all in. We're buried up to our armpits and bodies. I got up in the news this morning, and it was just an obsessive narrative about all of the sheriff that was slaughtered down in Como last week, and the dead teenager's body that was found, and the death rate's really bad. We are living in corpses. We're the putrefaccio of dead, unredeemed matter. Mm-hmm. Matter that's asleep and unconscious. And I think Quentin Tarantino's whole film is an essay. It's really not about hoods and mafia and malls. It's about us, about all these dead, persona-driven figures in us. And we're all in Denny's. We're eating in Denny's 24 hours a day. That's where. I mean, it's a wonderful place to have this scene take place. Denny's is where we live.
I was struck,
shadow of Denny's.
I was struck with the Kurosawa's Seven Samurai. And then how much
certainly not the action, but the feeling of the hero in both places is the same. What's so interesting and terrifying is that in Kurosawa, he's clearly a good man. And here, he's clearly a bad man. What's going on when the bad people are the ones in touch with the numinous and the good people are cut off from it? That you actually have to, you know, go out and be involved in a violent crime before you feel alive.
And the interesting thing, but you're probably still thinking that one of the things that our key narrator, the voice of the self, is discovering, I think he's discerning the part of him that's identified in past ego narratives with the Demiurge. He was the creator, he was the I'm the bringer of vengeance and death and judgment, and I create the world after my own image. And he's trying to rise to something deeper. There's a little kind of theology of alchemical transformation going on in him. Anything else that you want to say? There's a really poignant vignette. I want to remind you that I believe all film, I have never seen a film that's not true, I welcome anybody to kind of, I think all cinema, the most crass pornography, the worst B-grade film, every piece of film I've seen, if you look at the subtext, what the French talk about when they go to the accredited, the subtext of film, all film is about the redemption of lost innocence. I have never seen a narrative. It's about early life trauma and the redemption of lost innocence. All film is about its transformation and redemption and about trying to get these alchemical and Gnostic processes to work again so that the soul can be cleansed. I had never seen a film. And again, there was a certain sweet innocence. You really hope that that couple, and of course they are the oppositional tension to the mass, you hope that this young soul and woman really can reflect now and hold the reflection long enough that they don't have to live through the persona shadow darkness. We don't know, but there's a realistic part of it, so they probably won't hold it longer than a block down the street. Mm-hmm. But there's always the hope. We are touched by the innocence. We are touched by the renewed innocence in this kid who clearly had that, you don't even have to know, that he had a shattered childhood. To see him see real beauty in him, we are touched by it. Mm-hmm. We are always looking for the redemption of all things.
Well, I saw the case not at all as now chemical substance. I saw it more in like whole tilt's version of ultimate concernment versus penultimate concern. Because to me, the birth of the seeker archetype is just the first crack or beginning of the alchemical journey, questioning. And so we don't know what's in that case, but I think that's more of a statement of how money, the gold of our culture, has become the ultimate concern, and it's the penultimate concern. So, the alchemical gold is that which is everywhere present and lies within. You don't have to acquire it. You don't have to shoot for it. You don't have to kill for it. So that's more how I saw that movie.
Except that, my sense is that there's probably no real gold in there, but what's in there is really more the Ark of the Covenant. I mean, that's what we're kind of excited about this is. And it really is not $1,500. Mm-hmm. Seeing through the eyes of the heart, it becomes, the penultimate becomes transformed into the ultimate covenant. My thing is it's another world in there. Mm-hmm. And it's really amazing. And of course, after a while, hopefully the goal will be that they don't need to carry it exteriorly. That's the thing in our culture. We carry these in an exterior way. We put them in briefcases. All the important things in our culture, you carry in briefcases.
That's why I didn't think it was a self-symbol, because everything's exterior in this culture, and it's everything seen outside of oneself. And I don't think that's how the role of the self is.
And since I'm like, if you would do a director's recut of that, maybe the last scene would be, because we're seeing, I think, the gold moving inside people. Mm-hmm. Inside of them. It'd be nice to see them go to a trash can. Because, one of the alchemists said we find the best gold is in the vaulter. Mm-hmm. Go back to the trash bin and throw this briefcase. It's not like your director, because he's now, they don't need to do any hole in this case anymore. Mm-hmm. It's taking residence inside there.
Mm-hmm. But the goal was the compassion that suddenly, to me, that was the real one.
Got out into the world, we're kind of opening up this. And it is, in a way, Winnicott might call that a transitional object of himself. He's a whole other briefcase.
Yeah, he used that word, didn't
he? I'm in transition. I mean, that's what's so funny about this. This guy of dumb guy just talking about royals and burgers and all things. But I need to tell you that I'm in existential transition. It's Kierkegaard said, on the edge of the great abyss, and fear of this is like marvelous data state, I'm in a bad day. I'm in transition. I'm talking to my animals. Don't hassle me. I'm in the process of interiorizing the gold inside the cage. Don't push me too far today. I'm in a very fragile chemical operation. I'm watching the retort. I can't be disturbed.
There's something very interesting about this, that Ringo and Honey Bunny are people for whom I think the ego and shadow are not clearly defined. They're some sort of vague notion, and they have fallen into a world of shadow. Everyone else exists within the world of shadow. They are some sort of vague point in between, and in the end, they get seen as naive because they don't understand the difference.
Well, they're in the midst of our culture. Often the masculine and feminine are very fused and projectively trapped, and they haven't separatio. They haven't separated this stuff out and gone through their own death and their individual. You see a lot of marriages, a lot of long-term relationships, people are very fused regardless of age. And yeah, that's part of the reflection that is necessary for both of them. They both need a lot of, and their names even. I talk about persona names, Ringo and Honey Bunny. They kind of cat names and real names. They call each other. But those are on the surface. They haven't been very reflective about their death and many given opportunities.
I seem to be still looking at everybody holding a gun on everybody else, which is at once humorous, but there must be some material underneath that, and that, of course, everybody's sitting there quietly having breakfast, and then all of a sudden this chaos starts developing, and so it seems like the transition, I mean, the resolution, the alchemical process starts because of the chaos, which all of a sudden erupts, which wouldn't have happened if there hadn't been chaos. But is there some other material about everybody pointing a gun at somebody else?
Well, I don't think you feel that way in this culture.
Well, it's lead.
Yeah. That's right. It's great. It is unredeemed lead.
It's
going to fill you with lead.
Can you agree
with me? This strange reflecting on when we do this in the culture. The movie show, listening occurs only under the threat
of a point of view,
of
violence and death.
And as you said, then only for a short time, maybe walk down the street. Mm-hmm.
And of course, the alchemists said, well, what do you think about Confucian? Alchemists say, not only is death a prerequisite, but of all ages, you must enter the chaos, what they call the massa confusa. And people, you can't begin your process unless you have symptoms, unless you're aware that you're being held at gunpoint and you're very anxious. Process doesn't happen unless you suddenly realize the chaotic, massive confusion of your existence. Now, it is interesting, it's under gunpoint, that's the way we both do business, and that really gets our adrenaline cooked. We don't know what kind of stew we're in until sometimes the psyche holds a gun to our face, and we realize how confused and chaotic our existence is, and how much we long for something more. And usually the thing, it goes badly because there's no consciousness in it anyway. What's remarkable here is we've got somebody redoing his ego narrative. And he brings an even consciousness to this whole situation because he's the one that carefully, he becomes a psychopomp in a way. He becomes the voice of Eros and of Eve and instruction. He is the Gnostic guider. Be cool! I mean, it's in the street language. You don't call that bitch to be cool, but he's starting to give instructions. Manson, hush. Be cool, buddy. Okay.
And he tells her to keep her down.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. I will take the sacrifice. You can trust me. But be cool. It's okay. It's all right, Yolanda. Mm-hmm. Talk to your boyfriend. It's all right. Talk to Ringo. Okay, Ringo and I are having a conversation. It's all right.
Well, in that sense, the gun serves a function of tenements. It's a container. Mm-hmm. And I think his needing the gun to point it at him is that he, too, needs a container. He's a container in that he's allowing them to listen. But he himself can't become the inflated ego again. He needs it. Reminder to stay
with them. So interesting, those of you that are helpers and psychotherapists and stuff, I mean, there are times that you have to hold it down on somebody. It's the only way they know. Don't do this. I never thought about that, but there are times that there is loving violence. I'm just thinking about that for a moment. It's an interesting image. But there are times when I hold a gun on people that I care about. I try to find something that has some kind of threat to it that holds the ego.
Something that was very startling.
I never thought of it. The lead is right.
In the Last Temptation of Christ, that image where Christ takes the sword, or the thing with an axe, even, but it was like this very violent thing. And Christ, I was like, wait, that is startling. You know, and there's that equivalent of a gun.
Well, in the alchemical phrase, when he gets in there, I'll look at him and those stationers, and I says, wait a minute, you're wrong. I came not to bring peace, but the sword. May mother be turned against daughter, and father be turned against son. I came to bring not peace, but the sword. And it's an alchemical
I just think it's going to, we're going to have a Pacific where it's going to be kind of an excellent weekend here, you know. We'll get Lucy training. Well, there's something alchemical about it. And if you think about it, I have lovingly, some of my best transformation moments have come when somebody's held a gun on me. It's the only thing that caught my attention. Mm-hmm. It's a psychic gun and held a gun on me. Now I got it.
Didn't he need to have a gun held on
me
too, so he didn't get
inflated? Well, it's a terminus, as Paul's talking about it. It really did provide a... It created... It was a total massa confusion. There would have been blood everywhere. Mm-hmm. But a man he's doing Michael White Mary therapy. He's rereading all these voice tapes. And looking at the ego's reevaluating his day's experience and getting underneath it to some depth level. And the gun... And his dialogue provided the timon. The alchemist, the timonos, there would have been no container for any of this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Had he not acted. He provided the container. It's a very interesting, there's a whole angle of this thing. Of course, this wonderful thing about film is, last night there was a woman who, she's apparently was moved to, that had been working in Hollywood a lot of directors. She's a script revising writer. And she was saying, you realize the directors don't create one. And I said, I know it's... And she says, this is all crass commercial. I said, I know, but I believe synchronistically it tricks everybody. The story comes through, and that's the wonderful thing about film. You get these great communities of directors and the crass money people. It's a collective media. But the trick is that the voice of Eros gets through all that crassness. It gets through all that kind of script. And I'm sure a lot of this, and not even Tarantino thought about script conferences, it's just the wonder of images when you begin to alchemically cook them. They're infinite in their reflective capacity to open the case of them.
I'm stepping out of the union model just for a second. I'm thinking just a conflict resolution. If there is no container, there probably would not be a conflict resolution.
Nobody's held to it. It's a namasa. If you don't have a container, you can't resolve things. If there's no container, you will continue to project off all of the split parts of your being on somebody else and make them carry your shadow. If there's no container, you never bring the projection home. Mm. You constantly split off that phonic thing that's eating at us out of our own primal experience. We'll split it off. All the badness. We'll make everybody responsible for the pain and darkness that happened to us, and we'll make them become monsters. We won't confront and have to die with the monster into some kind of transformative path of the way. We'll constantly project it away. There's no container. And that's what happens when there's chaos. People just, they project away. International relations, there's always going to be war until we find some kind of way to stop projecting the great thing of power, the evil empire thing of the Reagan moment of the Soviet Union. So that kind of projection goes on, there'll always be war until we recognize our own darkness and ourselves responsible for it. That's a hard thing. In our time, probably the most vivid thing about that was Jimmy Carter. It didn't hold, but it was amazing because I think they trusted Anwar Sadat. And Menachem Begin trusted that Carter was fairly clean of projections when he invited him to Camp David. Mm-hmm. I invited him to call the projections back. Mm-hmm. That conflict had been going on for 30 years, ended for a while, because it was a container provided by somebody who was relooking at his ego narrative, but probably relatively clean of his toxic, was pretty reflective. Mm-hmm. They will bring somebody into a container and something was solved for a brief period of time. I think that's very true. There's no container, there's no soul wall. And I'm struck by Edinger's thing. I mean, in one level, I think it's not even another level. I'm quite moved. This notion that big international relations won't work. It's only when we meet a certain critical threshold of all of us that have done our own alchemical work with pulling our own projections back and dealing with our own massive confusion and learning how to carry our own guns with grace. That's such an interesting principle. And to carry our heart with grace and speak and to have containers for that in ourselves, that the world will find peace.
Well, I'd also say that, and mixing apples and oranges, maybe it seems like that.
That's alchemy, does it? That's a great process to mix apples and oranges.
It would imply that there has to be a grief and loss and acceptance process going on for the penetration to take place. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Maybe the quarter.
How are we doing time-wise, by the way?
We've got about 5 to 10 minutes. I might watch it in advance.
About 10 minutes.
Okay. How do alchemists, and or compared to Jung, define good and evil?
Well, I think what Jung came to, I think Jung's answer to that would be, I cannot define it. I can only tell you the one thing I know. It's not just provatio bono. The Roman Catholic Church and most Orthodox theological systems, not just Catholicism, but most systems, say that evil is but the privation of good. The good has no kind of organicity of its own. And Jung came to believe that evil was a real phenomenon.
was a real external embodied phenomenon. And that the archons and the demiurgs existed and existed in the outer world existed as was a real organic force and presence, and it was a real oppositional companion and tension, and that God had a big hunk of evil in her that needed to be transformed. I think he also felt it was the fuel of transformation, creation. Without evil, there would be no individuation. The evil's an important goal.
See, I think that's, you know, when we look at all this and we're discussing this, especially when we talk about, like with Sigourney, we were last night, like evolutionary purpose and Eros being behind that. See, I think that's an amorphous area that's why I'm always curious. I've been really, like, boring over this with the alchemy stuff lately. But what is really good and what is really evil? Because that's a real mass that confuses right there.
Well, and I think the process is to not do away with evil, but to engage it and dialogue with it and to embrace it in a conscious way. Mm-hmm. And that's why those Greek concepts of Eros are not just light, but she speaks in the dark and the hidden and the sun and surprising ways too, that there is Eros and evil. We start getting conscious. This character, the guy that's discovering the script, he's the most Eros-rich figure in the room.
Well, I see the word Eros as, you know, as well as when we talk about Sophia, as a very unifying principle, just as well as the individuation principle. So if I were to give my own definition to what is really good or evil without overlays of morality, that which it seeks unification, relational, you know, love in the big sense of the word. So if we think of Eros as really meaning that unifying love energy of the self, which I think the East well describes, like with the term Satchitananda, which means light, consciousness, and bliss. You know, Eastern religion, I think, has a very excellent field of being able to describe Eros a lot better than the Western culture. So it's, to me, Eros is not just a force that comes from our human self, it comes from the divine self itself.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, that's just something I'm throwing out, and I'm very curious as I go to these lectures to hear, because this is where I hear all this discussion.
And I think Eros is a fundamental energy. I want to say it's not just a polarized energy of the opposites. I think Eros really is the voice of the self. And it's a voice that speaks through both the integrated good and darkness of this world, and the self contains all of it.
Yeah, like Eros at the top of the triangle, maybe, and whatever we call good or evil, maybe on either side.
Yeah, Eros carries the voice of both. And evil becomes manageable when it's given voice. I know what I'm saying. When evil starts is given an erotic voice, it becomes possible to work with it. It's then when evil then says, I'm trying.
Mm-hmm.
Very hard.
Yeah.
Huh. To be the shepherd. Eros is beginning to stick in the dark. Eros is crying. And it's a relational cry. Oh, I believe that. It is the relational. It's when existence becomes essence.
Well, this is a question again on the side. Have you ever come up with a list of questions for the level one movie goer that you could have a template and walk out of a movie? You know, you have to. I'm sure you can do it just real quickly. I don't always go to movies and get the same thing you do. I mean, I'm very one-dimensional, you know what I mean?
Well, three questions. Three big ones. I just did it today. Where is ego? Where is the self? And what is the narrative of the film's description of the difficulty of relationship between ego and self? You can ask that of every film. That'll get you into the heart of the darkness and the life of any piece of art, actually, I can think of. It's a pretty easy model to work with. Where's the ego? Where's the voice of the ego? Where is the voice of the self? And what is the disruption between the lack of, you know, in language today, where's the lack of Eros between them? And you're off and running. And it just starts unfolding. And it really is helpful to think about who is speaking for ego and where is the self? Because embedded in that, the self is the possibility for reflective chemical transformation. You have to locate the self. That's what happens to the characters in the film. And that's why I feel, and it's amazing to me how powerful it is. I mean, when you think about what a powerful projecting medium that film, if it's really good, we walk into this uncomfortable theater, sitting in uncomfortable chairs, with coughing, crying, yelling, wheezing, strange people, the dark filled with all sorts of bacteria and mucosa. Very popcorn, and within 30 seconds we suspend belief, and we are projected into these images bigger than life. It's an amazing meeting, and we're gone. We are in the alchemy with it, and so we get out of it, Of course, the reflective thing is we also discover we're locating up in a projective way up on that screen, we're locating the self in ego, but what we're really doing is locating within ourselves.
Question three could be if it's assumed, where's the voice of the ego, where's the voice of the self? Question three could be implied the tension of opposites.
Oh, that's opposite,
yeah. What's going on in these tensions of opposites?
That's right. It's just disrupting the ability of the ego to have an eros-rich connection to the self. Because Edinger himself, years ago, he coined the phrase ego-self-axis. The whole goal of Jungian analysis is to create an axial, and in my language, eros-rich relationship of the ego to the self, respectful and eros-rich. And why is this disrupted? What are the oppositional tensions that create the disruption? And how can I be more reflective about those opposites in a way that brings about a transformational gentling of the ego inside the embrace of the self? And to learn against our instinctual... Again, midlife gives us the instinctual wisdom. We're learned instinctually to fear chaos. And what analysis teaches us, and what great contemplative tradition is, that we have to learn to fall into the chaos. Awake and alive. Not dead and unconscious and dead. That's a heck of a thing. It goes against all our instinctual trainings. Whereas, yeah, I'm supposed to recoil and pull a gun and be scared. Where's it coming from? I heard that noise. Where do I shoot? Where do I go?
I have to go to the bathroom and I want to go home.
Well, that's the other voice of this. That to me was the voice of the early damaged child.
Yes.
In all of us. In every film, the goal is to get back to the early, not only the personal wound. And I think in this culture, the developmental is pretty right. Most of us have been pretty badly wounded 18 to 36 months. Most of us. I think Alice knows right, 90% of people going to psychotherapy analysis are self-damaged human beings that have a real intrusions into their core integrity very early in life. Not maliciously or evilly, but my parents had been wounded themselves. And when they started to separate, the parents could not bear that. And so there was either an abandonment warning standpoint, an annihilation warning, and the child had a very toxic thing to have kind of a start. And that was her deep narcissistic wound. I got a pee on my car. It's very poignant.
Mm-hmm.
And the shepherd, the thing is, I think we know the shepherd heard that. He had a bear, and he knew how to handle it. And the animal, like, it's okay, Yolanda. Want to go? Point at daddy, you're doing just fine.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get you to the bathroom real quick.
Mm-hmm.
Don't worry about it being messed. We'll get you in the bathroom. It's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And if we get through this day, my hope is the shepherd, maybe you'll get home and settle down.
Mm-hmm.
I really like it.
And you insisted that her lover established that link.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't say, we're proud of you. He said, you tell her that you're proud.
Yeah, that's right. Ringo, you reflect that. You mirror back. You reflect back. You see something in the case. You reflect back some beauty in it, Ringo. Have enough left over now to give someone away compassion.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great image. Mm-hmm. And marital therapy, I mean, that's one of the touching things. They're so hurt. It's very hard for them to reflect anything but the projected darkness. And one of the really early tricks. And there are not many else. I do. Laura Dawson and I, maybe 40 of the international thing, I really believe you can work analytically with families and couples. A lot of voodoo about only doing this stuff in the business of nonsense. Some of the most powerful archetypal stuff that I've had, analytic stuff, has been with couples. And the work is rich there. And one of the early stages is to learn how they can reflectively give back some of the goodness in the soul instead of just some of the negativity and darkness in the soul. And of course, couples come in the midst of massive confusion. I mean, they're in the midst of chaos. That's why they come. It's a rich alchemical bath. And the goal is, oftentimes, I had never thought of it, but I have to hold a gun on both of them. Because this guy, why don't you tell him the only goodness you see in him? I mean, it's hard, but tell him. Tell him. Come on. Let's get you home.
Hold
on me, too. It's a whole new image. I mean, it's kind of hard to think about therapists as gun toters, but it's important.
I have to go to the bathroom.
Is it noon?
I'm not going to go home, but I encourage all of you to come back at 12:20.
20-minute break to buy books, go to the bathroom, and go home, and come back. Go arm yourselves. I'm about to try and get my 45.
John Beebe thinks he only saw one film in the last 3 minutes. He hates films.
Maybe he'd like it today.
Well, I just think it was, you know, we all have aesthetic darknesses, and I just think that was a blank spot. He apparently, too, was quite indifferent to music for later on in his life. And he was exposed to it. But, I mean, you can't expect everything out of him, but he had, he also had strong feelings.
whatever reason, struck him something on it, so he didn't go.
He had enough on internal cinematography.
Yeah, well, I said, yes, I was going to say, you kept seeing a movie going on all the time.
Just a following question. My level one template is going to go over to
I someday I would really like to write an introductory book about how to go over. I understand that it wouldn't be from a depth and television and psychology.
You're thinking about that. How to go to movies 101 kind of thing. I mean, it's just because it's
great. Well, it feels like me. I hope we have, you know, how is this guy going to get afterwards? We're just going to give ideas. Now, my question is, voice of the ego, voice of the self, the intention of the opposite. And I can see that number one on the story level in general.
Uh-huh.
It's an individual. So how far down do you go?
As far as my natural heart gets into it. That's why I say, those three, you want it. Once he gets going, it starts alchemically coaching you. Those three questions work over and over again. Well, if you ever get a film discussion group, you go to movies and think what you want to be, which is a great community experience. I've got a group I go to. Those three questions, and the group then gets into the group, provides a kind of seminar.
Well, yeah, because people have different perspectives.
Just like they're in here. It's just fun. It just starts thinking. Great stuff starts happening. Quickly, before we get into film, modify your book. we were talking about... I thought I'd go a direction I had. This is a side show, but we seem to be talking about projection as a central alchemical operation. So I thought I'd quickly run through a little bit of material about alchemy and projection. Ettinger suggests and implies an important precursor to an alchemical operation is what he calls the fourfold downward movement of energy that starts. It should be starts from above. Very much like the Gnostic thing. You've got the anthropos, Quaternio, the heavenly world up here. That's the spirit world. And then as it drops into the animal level, the shadow of the Quaternio, the dark. I had never thought recently I was reading, it's a very interesting, for all my thing about animal stuff, animals and anima. The ancient Greeks called animals animals because they believed they had the spirit of Zoe, or vitalness in them. I never thought I had seen anima buried in animal before. That was a quite interesting thing to me, but that's why the Greeks valued animals as carrying that divine spark. Pretty close to the spark that's in us. It's pretty anthropomorphic, it's kind of interesting. Then the vegetable level, paradise, the quaternial image, it is the garden. So we've got the heavenly image, the dark image, the garden image. And then the mineral image level, the lapis quaternio, or the crystalline level of existence. And the alchemists want to work with all of those. And then Ettinger believes, and I think this is one of the real brilliance of the book I had to build the argument for me. It's a pretty good summary of Conjunctio. But the brilliance is that the almost indecipherable conclusion of that book is Jung's climactic discussion of the unus mundus, the fruits of the conjunction. And Ettinger does as rich a job of any human being I've seen of making that clear. You know, the more I read you, I think you thought you were all ponderously and Germanic and some clear and some selective words. I just think he has so much concentrated stuff in him by the end of his life. As Ettinger suggests, we will be reading Jung as theology for the next several centuries. The man was an ethical man. By the end of his life, he had worked this stuff so much. And I read it now, and I read it 10 or 20 years ago, and I said, I didn't see that before. It is actually brilliant and similar, and there's so much. But Ettinger does a nice current job of unpacking it. And he says this crucial stage of the conjunction, again, that the whole alchemical goal is the transformative conjunction of these oppositional energies. Minerals with spirit, salt with luna, salt with sulfur.
Which Ettinger book are you thinking?
The Mysterium Conjunctionis. He's got some of the books. He's got a thin little paperback on the conjunction. It's a nice introduction to it. And, of course, Anatomy of the Psyche is a great introductory look at alchemy. In fact, I'd read them in that order. I would read Anatomy. If you're going to read Ettinger, I'd read Anatomy of the Psyche first. It's a real nice talking about the alchemical operations and the whole alchemical view from the human point of view. But he's got a thin little paperback on the conjunction. It's a pretty quick reading and a good read. And then when you're ready, you've got some kind of concepts, and you're ready for a little challenge, because to do it well, you should have a copy of the Mysterium, and should actually, I encourage you, you've got to do it. Get the Mysterium Conjunctionis. There were a series of lectures he gave down in L.A. And he gives assignments at the beginning of each one of the chapters. Read the Mysterion, then read his annotated gloss. It's hard work, but it's great. You'll get through the Mysterion, and you'll get through it with a lot of richness. But the end of that is so dense. I mean, you have to plow. That's the thing about it. You have to plow through pages of what seem like, because our culture is so distant from this Renaissance image or image. And then he gets into this very high-powered discussion of conjunction. But Edinger does a nice summary job. He says, the ascending second stage of life. This is my gloss, alchemical opera. This is what happens in the second stage of life. This is the alchemy we perform with the opposites. This is when in middle life and how it really dawns on us, we can't just be a kid and kill our way through. I want to try real hard. That's why I wrote wanting to flip. Stage one, what you call the unio mentalis, which comes out of the alchemical literature. The soul and the spirit unite. And they separate from the body. You'll often see that, like in the Rosarium, you just often it would be you'd see the little cupids leaving the putrefying and mortifying bodies in those images. The soul and spirit fly off, the masculine and feminine parts of the ethereal work of consciousness. They fly away from the body and spirit. And that is the union mentalis. Now, nice thing, Edinger does a nice part to the body, in a funny way too, the body gets rid of all of this imaginal pressure that's put on it. The soul and spirit can kind of go off and get together for the first time, and the body can just really veg and die, and really get into its energy, undriven by the imaginal heats of the spirit and soul. It has its own integrity. It's an interesting process. Stage two is the union of the unio mentalis with the body. They go off and do some chemical processing. Then the little cupids and the Rosarium figures and the putrefying bodies, and they fly away to those clouds, and the clouds disappear. Spirit and soul are left. There's a couple of dreadful scenes of putrefaction. These bodies, the king and queen merge, and they become kind of a unisex corpse. And then the clouds, the moistening. Remember the four elements: the hot, cold, the dry, and the moist. The moistening clouds leave with the goo of the zoe and essence. Then the clouds combine. The cupids are flying back down to the body. They're going to join the body again. After this kind of dry spirit. That's the union of the unio mentalis with the body. And stage three is merger of the second stage, this amalgam here. This is our individual experience. It's our connection with the self, with the unus nunus, the one world, when the alchemical process is over. Well, that's one way to think about projection. About
on stage three, I'm kind of curious, and again, I'm probably trying to translate things like that. In the Eastern philosophy, where you come into a period of self-realization, that
sure.
Or you're actually,
well, actually, could some self-realization stages could be stage two. It's an awakening to the macrocosm. The microcosm heals its oppositional dissonance, calms it down, feels a sense of its own unification, and it's a realization of the self-realized and an opening to the macrocosm. And then the microcosm connected, co-joins.
Full. Where you would actually perceive light in all things.
That's right. But there would be, you know, there is a mystical charge to this experience. And you can see this in analysis where people, in our culture, we're so split, psyche and soma, so split. And I get a lot of clients that are filled with body symptoms. They're totally unconnected to their psychological distress. They split. And the dramatic realization of how much the body and the soul have in common, and how much love and affection they have. And it even shows up in the dream material. That's that stage two thing. And then you get the kind of the deep conjunction dreams where people take this outside themselves and see the macrocosm, the beauty, and their connection with the all. A stage three example of somebody would be Buckminster Fuller, who I'm sure is a man that does these other stages. A stage three example of beyond just himself was once I saw him near the end of his life in 92 or 93. He preached at Tacoma. And he has this famous, I call it his geodesic dome version of the Lord's Prayer. It's a kind of a process version. And he gets a chance, it's quite wonderful. He gets about halfway through it. He's kind of almost there. And he says, have you ever thought, you realize that things are so interconnected that when you jump on the surface of the earth here, there's a ripple on the other side of the universe. That's a stage three comment. That's somebody who's done stage two and is joining now with the earnest moves. That's outside himself.
Your perception in the West, I'm asking for a judgment. Would you say the West as probably as a masses of people probably are stuck in too.
Absolutely.
And therapy, foster, medication.
That's what you were saying, the alchemical process, individuation. How are you doing? Therapy or spiritual? And there are lots of ways to do it, too. Remember, I think union analysis, I'm not as... I like Edward Edinger a lot, but I think that statement about this is the fullest expression ever and all that, that's a little inflated. I think it's a stopgap.
Ego is a little center with a little sum of small s or a little center with a small c, and self is a big center, and it's a big sum, you want to think. In the Renaissance thought of planetary energies.
The ego is within self, isn't it?
Or another way to speak, talk about it, like the planets, it orbits around. It's an attractor. The self is, it is both the center and it is the circumference of the circle of being. All sorts of mystical ways to think of it. The self is a paradoxical concept. We can only approach it. We can never really know it. In a way that changes the turn of the century in the variety of religious experiences. It's not the kind of method they had. There was Richard Reason experience of their life. We thought William James was really interested in mystical experience. It really is ironic that the guy that birthed American pragmatic empirical psychology. I lived in American Psychological Association in August. Because the IAP meeting was too expensive to hurry. So I'm willing to spend $300 for the hotel room. Usually, this year, I go to ABA meeting because for $125 you get access to 1,500 workshops. But the workshops, 90% of them are statistical, empirical, dead meat ego visions. And they all claim, origin, William James. But that many workshops, there's still 10% on depth psychology, psychoanalysis, and things like that. The guy's got really great survival. Occasionally, I drop something just to see how bad a shape cultural psychology was horrible. But William James, the author of this, was interested in mysticism primarily, studying varieties. If you've not read it, it is one, it could win a literature prize. It is a beautifully written book. It says three things about it. He's really talking about encounters, ego encounters with self. He says three things about those experiences. His study showed it. When you encounter it, it's inevitable. You really cannot put it in words. We can approach the self, but we can never put words in it. That's the mystery about it. It's paradox. It stage logos. Logos in us wants to get it. But we'll never get it till logos rests in the arms of Eros. Then we get intuitively It's ineffable. It's noetic. It touches the very core of our being. One more round. He did. That's what you know. And then he'd say, and we don't even know what God is. That's a paradoxical crazy word to use. I don't know if it's the elevator. And it is a paradoxical word. It's a color word. So we don't know what it is. But you approach something. We have feeling. When we think about God, whatever God means to us, when we get past our religious dogma, we try ourselves. Like, when we just let the word be erotic for us, it starts meaning all sorts of stuff. And I think that's what it is. So it's ineffable. It's noetic. It touches the core of your being. And the human condition, our experiences with it, sadly, are transient. We can never hold on. We can remember the encounters, but that's a great God. We just love to live it all. We can't do it. We hold on a little bit when our car breaks down after we've been on a spiritual retreat for a couple weeks. We can hold on to a little bit of it when we're trying to get our car to fit it. He won't stay for many days. It's just go on retreat with it. He missed the retreats there. It's noetic, it's ineffable. And it's transitory. What's the self? Well, we talked about, and yesterday I was talking too about ways of working with verticality. The Gnostic and the alchemical ways are a little contrasted. The Gnostic view is they flip this pyramid up on its backside, and the big part of the pyramid is up here, and the divine unus mundus is up at the top, the self. Coincidentally, the other companion of self is Kairos, God time, being time, noetic time, timeless time, eternal time. Sure.
Do you know anything about that?
Not a lot. But whenever you read about Kairos and the Kairos inside the Greek myths, there's the sense of the introduction of timelessness and the defeat of Logos.
Is Kairos and Chiron connected?
There are connections, Chiron and Kairos. But the biggest thing Kairos is in Greek is simply a description of divine time and chronological time. In fact, all Greek myth, the telling of Greek myths, any Greek or Hebraic myth, as Mircea Eliade said, is an attempt to get Kronos in relationship with Kairos. eternal time. What Eliade would say, to recover things iliud tempore, as they were in the beginning, to contact original time. That's our thirst for Genesis. That's why Genesis fascinates, befuddles us, and that creation is fascinating, because it's a story about original time. We're interested in creation stories, about getting ourselves back to it. When we're in psychological trouble, we have symptoms, we want to get back to original time.
So when we tell them the story that is our dream, are we trying to make problems with Kairos? Because it never seems to quite make the same kind of sense.
Sure. And what the Gnostics did is they said there was this perfect God and divine thing, and then even in this perfect divinity, it's kind of interesting. You know, you read Answer to Job. Jung really seems to suggest that God is needing analysis with us as much as we need analysis with God. It's a very interesting thought. So God's got God. She's got her complexes, and she's got her neuroses, and she needs our companionship as much. She's co-evolving with us, and you get the sense that something in God, there's a complex in God that gets split off in the Gnostic myth. And did you about Lucifer wiling up the angels or whatever the story is? They leave heaven and kind of off. They're not going to worship this new creation man. There are all sorts of stories about this. You know, God does this perfect sculpture and then prays all the angels like they're supposed to worship. And Lucifer says, oh, no. You know, disappears and falls into the John Donne kind of thing. However it is, these divine essences fall, wanting to find their own place, wanting to leave home. Parts of God maybe wanting to individuate. It's a kind of amazing way to start thinking about it. They leave home. But there's always down. The only way from home. You know, we're kicked out usually down. All of us had to leave home sometime. I usually felt like kind of out and down. We never seemed up. You know, like this, if getting out of home is a story of useless. You kind of remember what it was like for you. If it's happened to you. I've got people who are 40, 50, 60 not left home. But if it's happened, usually the trajectory seems to be out and down. But maybe part of God's thing, and whatever it is, they get down there. And then they get kind of split off from this compassion and goodness, and they get into kind of power, and they become these archons. And the head archon becomes demiurge, and gets kind of inflated and says, God created, I can create, I'll create this, I'll create a parallel world. And that's how highly the material world came into being, this dense material world, ruled over by the archons and the demiurge. Last night in the film, Bishop is a wonderful spokesperson. And even has, he's got what a demiurge would call himself, a bishop. This inflated desire to kind of create and control. It's out of control. That's the power move. That's what creates nuclear wars and Sodom and sins and this demiurge in all of it. It's a wonderful myth. But in the Gnostic myth, it all falls down here. And it's the feminine side of God, Kina, Sophia, whatever it is, the mist, who sees this and sees the trouble that the created ones, we in the midst of that fallen, heavy, material universe are in. And out of heart, almost you see her, just her heart makes her fall out of heaven. She goes tumble again, out and down. And she can arrest herself. She's got some kind of skydiver's parachute or something. You never quite believe it. She stops in the Valentinian system about the 31st to 32nd of these many levels of being, from really thick, heavy, fallen, dense, evil matter, pilot, to the new, the divine release part up here at the top of God. She's about halfway. But in there, she works for the redemption, to try to put a limit on the darkness and to urge then all of us that are stuck in an ego suit. Remember, this is upside down. That's a descent. And then the whole Gnostic liturgies and the non-dualist system are instructional systems about how then you start scaling the ladder back up to get to the Venus Moons in the world. And with the help of Sophia, she gives you instructions about how to face the bishops of the world and say no. There was instruction in last night's film about what to say to the demiurge. Instructions are no and shut the gate and lock it. I mean, those are pretty interesting instructions about what Sophia does. And she listens. She lets him in. She comes in and she says no. Some instructions and all these great within the Naganapa body diagrams. There's lots of ascent dialogues about how to be conscious. A lot of it is Sophia or Zoe, the ancient Greek vital life force, or the Shekinah instructor, the Shulamite woman, which is the dark woman, one turned dark by the sun, the Song of Songs. You know, the woman, the feminine side of that, is a woman turned dark by the sun. She's a Shulamite. And she instructs us about how to get back there. Well, the alchemical view is the total other way around. In the alchemical view, we are stuck down here in this lousy stuff. We want to get a trajectory. We want to get into the prima materia, the base matter, and we want to ascend back to the humanist movements. We want to somehow cook this process. And maybe even then come back and transform all the bases around us and bring all of this world in the non-duals. We go back once we've... It's kind of that Mihayana, Mahayana in the Buddhist tradition, the greater or lesser vehicle. Once you get some transformation in the alchemist, we get a formula. And the good alchemist, the greater vehicle alchemist, then wanted to take that formula back to people who were conscious enough to understand it so that they could transform their darkness, eventually get this all this darkness transformed back into the divine humanist movements where it belongs. I kind of like that vision, that kind of alchemical process. But either model, there's distensus and astensus going on. Another way to look at this is the term of sacred theologian was Plotinus. This is another set of lectures from Editor. He does a really nice job with this stuff. But Plotinus, he starts a lot of his works by saying the alienated souls forget their worth. That often happens. I mean, people come into analysis with me. I know people who have forgotten their worth most of the time. Good therapists about knowing if you can just stay quiet and not react, you can respect and see the worth of other people. That's about the best thing you can do, is just see the worth of people and value it without getting anxious. People have forgotten their worth in this culture. Any day you go to look at an I-5 when you're out there and you're like, oh, that's a good thing. Look and see if those people are feeling much of their worth. Just look at their face. Or going to an office building, or look at your colleagues, or look at your family member, look at yourself. We're a culture that's forgotten our own sense of worth. A very moist idea. And according to this, this is his image of the same following. There is the one of the self at the top. Right underneath that is what he called mind or nous, the Greek word for the kind of collective unconscious. And underneath that, he said there is soul and psyche, the autonomous anima and animus. And beneath that is this dense matter, ego and shadow function, this kind of heavy, dense material world that we're caught in. It's a world of just the conversation of ego and shadow. We saw that in the labyrinth last night, where all of those prisoners were running around trying to catch the interjects and kill the Stani Great Mother. But in a non-dualist, this is what I like about Ettinger, I want to keep reminding you that the vision of Jungian psychology, I think, kind of Gnostic and alchemical systems are non-dualist systems that don't think this matter is bad. It needs to be redeemed. Matter represents the completeness of God's thought. It's a really interesting idea. It's not fallen. It's part of God. You think about it, it's part of God's individuation. And the matter's not bad. It's only unconscious matter that's in our way. And we shouldn't go create crazy split-off systems like they did in some Gnostic systems where they left the body. And they cursed the body, and they rejected eroticism, and they rejected sexuality, they rejected the joys of this earth, they rejected any kind of beauty as possible. That's bad Gnosticism, bad alchemy. Last night, did you see Eros and the scent of green defiant? Did you see her break the vows, the broken matter? And did you see her great heart take that? I just want to weep when I see that she took a piece of that beauty and put it next to her cheek and wept. She knows the value. The material world and its brokenness that she cares. I don't know if you remember that. It's very moving. She is Eros incarnate all the way through that film. Eros incarnate. And she sees in the world all the beauty of matter when it's soul inspired. And fish wiggling in a pan, and rice pouring into a woven basket. And the plants of the inner garden, and an old man that has pined for a childhood lover for 50 years. And a depressed, widowed wife doing Buddhist rituals and Buddhist years every day. And seeing her lover, gives us 30 seconds, we'll see her lover for the first time. She later can't get away. She gets involved in a little house and we'll have to see the film. And that wonderful look of encounter. The sweet seconds. And it's the end. Mind is an organic living community of interpenetrative beings. These ideas, these Greek ideas, these ideas we got taught and sounded flat in high school and college. They are interpenetrative beings. They are organic psychic realities, we talked about last night, which are once forms and intelligences, awake and alive. The alchemists knew that all of this stuff they were putting in the retort, maybe asleep and unconscious, the alchemical process was to awaken it and to enlighten it. People come in with all this dead experience in there. They think there's no life there. And to their amazement, when they begin to talk, and when they begin to imagine with this imaginal heart, when they begin to do this renaissance, ars memoriae, when they get into reverie, it all awakens and comes to life. Sometimes painful life, but pain has got a lot of arrows. To their amazement, there's a whole circus of life inside them. A circus I saw with my father. A dead meadow comes along. Creativity. Intelligence is indeed becoming alive and awake. Thomas Aquinas. The Summa Man. Dead scholar of the church. I mean, we can think of his dustiest bones. But just how alive is Thomas. Soul finds the one through the aid of memory and recollection. Analysis called anamnesis. A reawakening, a re-remembering, and re-inspiring what we thought was dead. The great charge of the healing office is out there. And all of us are convinced from every literature, but that's what we're doing going up and down this ladder regime, is we're trying to awaken and enliven all of these dormant parts. And that's what the alchemists were doing in the alchemical operations.
So, before we see a film, I wanted to talk a little bit about these alchemical operations. What are they?
It's the first quick image. Minus, again, what we're working with. Tensions and opposites. All the great Chinese and Eastern and Western systems of alchemy. Eastern, from what I can tell, the only difference was they were interested in immortality. That was the kind of thing they were trying to do. The alchemical goal is always to distill this dark matter and to have the magical root to keep alive forever. And there's some of that Western. Western alchemy is interested in this essence, this grail, this philosopher's stone, the gold of real being. Some of them believed it was eternal life. Others just believed it had this value to be discovered. It was this beautiful thing. I think they believed contact with it survived death. But in all the system, it's oppositional tension between yin and yang. All the Eastern alchemists talk about there's this dialogue. We're creating a rhythm. Between salt and sulfur in the West and in the East. Primal elements. And salt and sulfur are pretty alive. Salt and sulfur do wonderful things in the laboratory. In the combination of amazing substances. Are there images of the king and queen? Those of you that were at Stefan's lecture, when he talked about the Rosarian pictures. Stefan does that well. There's the king and queen, and those that are getting into the Seleucio, into this battle, getting into the matter, and getting things awakened. Sometimes you have to die and wake up. That's the whole thing about the Rosarian images. Or Sol and Luna, sun and moon. Alchemy, and this is kind of an Edinger Gibson Holler summary of what I think alchemy is about. Alchemy, to keep the opposites in tension. Keep them in tension. You don't want it to get too quiet. You want the operation going. Interaction towards the desired goal of psycho-spiritual transformation through the intermediary transpersonal agency. And the various names. These are animate beings that they imagined when they went into the Ars Moriae. They thought they saw Thoth, one of the ancient Egyptian mystery gods, and the mystery of embalming, the alchemy of the Egyptian way into the dark night to go meet Osiris. Or Hermes, the messenger god of the Greeks that fluttered between Olympus and this world, conscious and unconscious, earth and heaven. Mercurius, which is the Renaissance alchemist image of this, the great mercurial figure that scuttled back and forth between these. Or Sophia. Sophia's coming on strong now. I think she's the most enlivened. The feminists of the Buddhist mythical movement, and she's the alive alchemical voice in our culture now, has been missing. And Sophia is probably the most active leader. Historically, it was Thoth, then became Hermes, in the Middle Ages, Mercurius. Now she's speaking and sounding most vividly, this alchemical intermediary agency, this personification, this psychopomp that guides us up this ladder of being to awaken and enlighten. It's probably Sophia. So, now, some key concepts. If you're going to watch a film, it's going to be brutal like last night. You're like, why is it showing this garbage and nuts in here? Well, let's take a look. First of all, some key Western alchemical notions and axioms. Death must precede birth. True. People come in to me and they say, when will I feel better? I usually have bounds to tell. I'm not too much interested in feeling better. What I'm interested in is juicy suffering. Not much interested in happiness anymore. What I'm interested in is transformative and redemptive suffering, not sadistic suffering. That usually requires that it's going to be a death experience. And death experiences usually are long and protracted. There's no quick coronary usually in psychotherapy. It's kind of a long psychic cancer. And people, you know, that's why people go to managed care. They're promised to something and do visits. I can't do that. The alchemist can't do that. Death must precede growth. It's a chemical notion. The stoic, fixed, specific pneuma is in life forms. Some of this came from stoic, Greek stoic philosophy. They believe that there is element and active in all of us. In both men and women, a spermatikos logos. It's a specific, inseminating fluid of being that's in all of us. It's a static, known element. And an alchemy is to get that element active so it fertilizes our psyche. Aristotle, who a lot of people credit with giving the first, that double, have you ever seen this? A kind of a double square, eight-pointed double square. And four of those squares are the four elements, earth, air, fire, and water. And that's together four qualities, hot, cold, moist, and dry. And all of the alchemical recipes, over and over again, they say, we must get this substance moist. Get it in solutio, we'll see that. We must get the substance cold. We must get the substance moist. We must get it dry. Transformation is attained through alchemically working the seven metals with the aid of the seven planets. The Renaissance came on strong with this image. And it really believed. It's this wonderful, magical thing. You go out at night, there's this giant beams that's going on. The microcosm and the macrocosm meet each other. I had a hard debate about which film to show you here. I picked the Russian film, but you've seen Immortal Beloved, the scene I wanted to show where he, the end of it, you've seen it where he encounters his childhood abuse, and there was this one scene where he escapes it. And when he's deaf, he's writing this great music, and the imaginal image was this childhood of this abusive family. He goes to Mother Earth, to Gaia, finds this pond and lays the cruciform, and feels all the planetary spiritualized metals. And he also, Renaissance image. We had that under a starry night. They were camped out high in the mountains, beyond the smog. You can feel the metals of the earth below you and the planets above you connecting through your heart. You can feel it going on there. You know this alchemical stuff and you intuitive.
So, I don't know
if
you're on metals and the planets, but I know the alchemists are also really into astrology and stuff like that too. But do you know what qualities, they were associated with?
They all depended on the cookbook and the alchemist. They were all different qualities ascribed. That's one of the next. Because they would get in a retort, and each one had a little bit of an imaginal take. We're going to talk about some of the basic themes on these charts. But then they would take this basic material and imaginally experiment with it. It was not a reductive alchemy. Just like any psychology, you'll never, or should have never seen, a definitive Jungian dream book, one of these A to Z kind of books that you have a dream about a dog and you have a dream about this planet. That's a reductive thing. The really great Gnostic and alchemists never got into a reductive system. They were intuitively open, had a basic idea in what these elements, but they actually became animal voices with the help of mediation of Sophia, the hermits, in their age, Mercury. Silver was often associated with the moon. Copper with Venus, Mercury with obviously Mercury, tin was with Jupiter, iron with Mars, lead with Saturn, gold with the sun. Of course, the sun being the self again, the company, gold hard to get. The two exhalations of the earth were real important. There was earth and smoke seeking fire. They believed in the Greek and some medievalists carried this on, create stones and minerals. That's the exhalations. And water vapor seeking air, which creates the metals. And it's the alchemy of stones and metals and minerals that creates the philosopher's stone. Originally, there were two active elements, sulfur and mercury, and their interactions created the whole goal of the alchemical retort was to get sulfur to relate to mercury inside the retort. And to kind of create this third, the tertium, talked about also, the tertium non doctor, the third idea, the transcendent function of the soul itself. And then Paracelsus, this kind of interesting character, it's not his name, but he said he was greater than Celsus, one of the great ancient physicians. one of his middle names was Bombastus. We got our name Bombast from. He was apparently quite a, what we call a narcissistic personality disorder, but he was a functional one. An old Bombastus Paracelsus expands the ancient world sulfury mercury theory to sulfury mercury and salt interact.
I can see why mercury and salt became basic principles, but why sulfur?
It's magical, and it comes out of magical places on volcanoes. Some of you, anybody been to Delphi? Well, if you've been to Delphi, you know it's one of the most magical places in the world. If you ever go to Greece, please include Delphi. And give yourself time. It's one of the real magic places on the earth. Not now, but in the ancient days, when you go there, there's a cleansing bath. It's kind of like a weekend analytical psychology experience. 2 years from this, in those days, you would go and take a holy bath under the shining cliff, the Placidides, and you do a little exercise. You'd go to the kind of Greek spiritual gym and work out. Kind of get into, again, the Greeks have this wonderful, they didn't slip the body away. My wife and I were in Egypt once for a month before we went to Greece our first time. And a week of that kind of embalming and tomb stuff is kind of good. After a while, I felt like I was kind of a necrophilia. Because it's all this preoccupation. The Egyptian thing's a little heavy after a while. And the body was disembalmed and eviscerated and it was kind of... And you arrive in Greece where the body's in joint. Delphi, the body's in joint. The body's spread there. They can send you a secret chamber. Put you on a little, you tell them, well, I'm having trouble, I see any dreams, and I never dream, when sending you to the basement. The tolos, the sacred tolos, and release defanged snakes in there to kind of help you crawl over you and that kind of stimulate dream. Why they thought that was stimulating. I mean, it's the same thing last night. You get in a library, it stimulates the unconscious. The conscious is fears and fantasy. Then you get a dream, and then when you're ready, you walk up the road, and there are the different shrines. They got their offering first there. You went to the shrine, the local place, you gave your money. Then you came to the divine feeder. You do an evening, the arts would open up, an evening of divine feeder. And plays about the Bacchae and Dionysius, under the Dionysian cakes. You do that. Then you take, after you've been physically and spiritually, aesthetically, culturally opened up, you come to the temple of Apollo Venus. And what happens? You took your dream, and in the basement of the temple, there was a postmenopausal woman, well, we've been told, that she was on a tripod, and what was she doing? She was breathing the sulfurous exhalations of the earth because they knew the magic of magma moving out of the earth. It was mystical. They would chant your dream to her, and she would go into a trance on that tripod, breathing, doing the alchemy. And the gods would come to her and mediate the meaning of your dream. She'd give it to the intermediary, and they'd come up and tell your dream, and you'd go on and reflect on that and change your life accordingly. So sulfur was a magical thing. It was the breath of the gods. It was the breath of the earth.
Also metallurgically, it is the substance that will extract metals from ore. Mm-hmm. Sulfur dioxide, sulfuric acid and copper and gold.
It will corrode and extract. It's a very powerful magical substance.
And what's interesting too about, let's see if I can get this right, if you take copper oxide and you put it in hydrochloric acid, it puts the copper in solution, you add iron to it, it precipitates out, let's see, iron sulfate, and the copper is free.
And it's a mystery, it's a magic. It's the kind of the most wild experience when we were little kids, but it's a mystery of this process. How does this happen? You can see where the alchemists got fascinated. These metals are not dead, they're not dead highly. There's a lot of iron. It dances.
So there's another way to look at it too, and that is if you look at the earth as retort, then the sulfur is what comes out of the earth.
What a wonderful image. And of course, if you've seen a lot of the alchemical images, the earth isn't exactly, you see that's in the big pelican, and the earth and the microcosm is inside the retort being cooked. And other times, you see these images as the whole earth and heavens meeting around the whole man and woman in the midst that's been alchemically renewed. The earth is a wonderful image. The earth is a giant retort, which it is. And, you know, I think, you know, sometimes I have a friend of mine says, we need to put it in perspective. We're all worried about all this pollution and stuff. The earth's dying. And my friend says, come on. This is a thin crust. When she gets ready to shake us off, we're just like a flea on the high of the water. You know, if it gets too far, and, you know, in a blink of time, a couple billion years, there will be no sign that we were even here. You know, earth is a living chemical. Lots of, and the Greeks knew breathing this living element.
Mercury and the Paracelsus. And Paracelsus is important because he provided a bridge from alchemy to modern medicine. But he also provided a bridge to take preserve the alchemical stuff to modern depth psychology. We forget his contribution, but he said mercury had a metallicity or spirit related to water. Sulfur had an inflammability related to soul and air. And salt had a fixity, a stability related to the body and the earth. And then somebody's asking, there were frequent astrological yokings to these operations too. And these are the great alchemical operations. And please, you'll read these words over and over again. Well, there's several books. Probably the best, the one I like the best and I find most accessible to get directly to alchemy, and she's not Jungian, but a woman named Alison Kudert, C-O-U-D-E-R-T. She's got a book titled Alchemy from Shambhala. And most of this comes from her, but there's numerous good books, but she is the easiest, and it's a wonderful book filled with some of the best alchemical images that I've seen.
So are a lot of
these... A lot of these things come from Alison Kubert.
Thank you.
In fact, you'll see some page references at the end of these charts, and that's where... Calcination, Ares the Ram. Kind of calcifying and firing the elements of the psyche. Coagulation, the clumping and hardening. Taurus the Bull. Fixing elements, Gemini the twins. They always talk about fixing between stages in the alchemical retort. Dissolution, dissolving the hard and rigid elements of the psyche into more life and easiness. Cancer the Crab. Digestion, Leo the Lion. And the green lion you often see in alchemical texts, eating the world. Distillation. Everything from moonshine to soul. Virgo the Virgin. Sublimatio, the rising into the air, getting an air equality, bringing an aeration to the substance. Libra, the scales. Separating out elements, alchemical operations to separate out the opposites. Scorpio, the scorpion. Serration, Sagittarius, the archer, cutting through things. Fermentation, you could put into that Capricorn, the goat. Putrefaxio and Mortifaxio, you could put in here. Multiplication, Aquarius, the water carrier, and projection, one of the great alchemical and Gnostic things, projecting our fantasies out in the outer world, Pisces the fish. Crucial factors in all of this of number and proportion. They went through great, you can't follow it, it's mystical about how they get these mathematical formulas. Kind of Pythagorean number mysticism. And Maria, the one becomes the prophet tells them, the one becomes the two becomes the three becomes the four, which is the all. And these alchemical, how they get it is Pythagorean number. And they'll write these numbers, these vast number equations. And it's a kind of a Kabbalistic number stuff. But number is important. Number carries. And like Ed just pointed out, when the ancient Greeks first figured out pi, figured out the formula, it was magic to them. They went out and slaughtered a bull and gave thanks to the gods. It danced. It was a magical notion. Or the birth of any kind of algebra, trigonometry, or simple mathematical equations. They're wonderful. Just that they're, when you were a kid in school and you first figured out mathematical operations, the first time you got it, there was joy about it. It is a magical thing. So number and proportion, a sense that things have to be in balance. There has to be a recipe. You can't ever let the psyche have one part get too inflated or deflated at the expense of others. And then there's a chemical interaction and connection. And both physical and psycho-spiritual alchemical operations. And here's that from their page number. And I'm going to have just one little final chart, and then we're going to look at a film thing. This one's an interesting introduction. The alchemical sequence, the ancient Greek world, you read a lot about this, is that what is the sequence? And you need to know that I agree with Edinger, don't get locked too much. It's relatively unimportant. The psyche can start at any one of these places and mix up the process. It's kind of like people say, you know, they read two essays on analytical psychology. Oh, when I come to therapy, the first thing I'll experience is a shadow, and then I'll constantly my own anonymous, my persona will get upset, then I'll get into the deep stuff, the quaternary images and spirit, and then I'll get into the self, and then I'm done. That's, I mean, people, and it's a general rhythm, but it's not always that way. I have clients that start deeply contained in the self, and then they have almost a schizophrenic break. They work, I mean, it's almost that they need a division, a hole, it's kind of hole in the middle of that stuff. It, so these orders and these numbers, just be intuitive about it. Your process may be entirely different. And the only reason you talk about this is hopefully it's stimulating your imaginal eye. It's awakening things you knew about your experience. But the early Greek things, the rubedo, was the passions were aroused, and then we dropped into our black experience in the Negredo, and we cooked it in our black despair and melancholy. And then the whiteness, the rubedo, or the fullness of our chemical awareness would rise out of the retort of our inner process. The Middle Ages, that kind of got locked into four stages. Black, we sound pretty human, the Negredo, the shadow stage. I mean, if you saw the Rosarium images, here's the king and queen. They're all persona. They got their robes and their persona stuff on, and they're perfect kings and queens. They're hiding all the shadow stuff. There's sinister things going on with the left hand if you look carefully at the images. We clearly see what's happening, but it doesn't take long. When you start working the alchemical stuff, our king and queen stuff lasts maybe two sessions, and pretty soon the genitals start showing up. And pretty quick, we're in the soup, and we're on the psychic mortuary table. We're down in deep Negrito. We are dead, and we are blackened when we're dealing with our shadow. We can't, through the wonder of projection, we can't keep throwing it on our fellow workers, or our family members, or our lovers, or our spouses. It's all coming back home to roost in this pretty brooding, dark world in Negrito. Then out of that, carefully cooked with it. The bodies begin to cook in the first firing. They took these at the fire, kind of changed it. There's a whitening of the chemical process. Some rubedo, some sublimazzi, little cherubic figures. You start looking at the smoke and the vapor, and you start imagining figures of soul coming out of dark highway. The anima, the animus, kind of prototypically begin to move. You start seeing the aliveness in matter, and the goodness in the midst of all of the dark, and the light in the midst of it. The Eros in the midst of all of the Logos, the Kairos in the midst of all of the Chronos. And then the passions come up. Eros really speaks her voice, and there's a redness. And she is there. Even in the labyrinth, her name is written on the wall. You start seeing it. When you hear her passion, the body begins to awaken, the psyche begins to get alive. A lot of people think, well, it's a good time to quit therapy. And this is a nice time to stop. Of course, what usually happens, in my experience, is that you don't then just get into the final yellowing and calcination and the final setting fire and it produces the gold of the soul. It gives you a little taste and it drops you right back down into a big pile of psychic feces again and you work a little bit longer. And it's like trying to crawl out of the pit. Last year I showed a woman of the demons at the Nazarene, but this woman is at the bottom of this pit, and the man gets stuck in and keeps trying to crawl out of this pit. Well, that's the alchemical operation. And the real brilliance comes when he finally figured out how to crawl out of the pit, he voluntarily went back in. Because he wasn't at the calcinating stage, and he knew he needed to come back. That the darkness in there had produced a whitening and a reddening and a passion. And the philosopher's goal is to be found at the bottom of the pit. Then people voluntarily stay in the process. So, a little bit of alchemical imagery. We're going to see the tail end of the V-hit cult movie. Imagine it will eventually have maybe almost the same popularity as the Rocky Horror picture show that they go to at midnight now. But it really came out of cult phenomenon. People said, "Look, well, I mean, it just came out in video." We're going to see the tail end of Pulp Fiction. The Quentin Tarantino thing. And you remember, it is a bizarre thing. A mafia guy's having Kierkegaardian dialogues about foot massage Big Mac in Paris and a quarter pounder called a Royale because there are metrics. I mean, all this data and information you thought you'd never were interested in and didn't want to know, but it's there.
We have a lot of food out. Would it be possible to just break for a couple of minutes?
Sure. It's a good idea. We don't have popcorn, but we've got even better things. For this, I wish this was available in movie theater. Great popcorn. We'll take about a 5-minute break.
I understand Travolta appropriately.
So maybe back and forth between the John Travolta figure and the English guy. Why would you pick that?
Those who want to be in control and do it by force of main will.
Okay. Interesting. So the two most ego-dominated people in terms of folks, in terms of logos and chronos, that you've been talking about, and kind of wanting control and get their will on the world, the English guy.
You're giving that $1,500. I'm going to kill him on general principles.
Give that Nimrod.
Nimrod.
Give that a Nimrod. $1,500. I'll kill him on general principles. Ego says it's not good business. Doesn't make any sense. They're general principles. General logos. So you go to me, don't do that. Kind of nice thing. General principles.
I would tend to say honey bunny.
What's that?
I would say honey bunny.
Honey bunny was the ego?
Yeah.
What would be your sense about why she carries ego function?
Seeing the previous part of it, you know, as it's kind of building up, there's this way that she becomes inflated over the process. I mean, just thinking of kind of development of the process with the ego, there's a way that she becomes seduced with the notion that we're going to do this thing, and then she launches into this almost megalomania. And when she's confronted, she really is confused and doesn't know what to do. And I think that that's true with kind of ego function in that way.
Kind of an anxious, symptomatic ego. Where's it coming from? Where's the danger? We're all okay up there.
What am I supposed to do?
A panic ego.
There's another element of the ego too, and that is in the history of how he blew people away with telling them the story, I think he is telling a previous ego story.
Mm-hmm. About the devil.
About how he used to interpret the mm-hmm. meaning of the Bible mm-hmm. in an ego dominated way.
Mm-hmm.
Very good.
Mm-hmm. Where is the self? The goal hard to find, the unus mundi, the one world. Where is the self?
He's trying real hard.
What's he trying real hard for? So if I think he really is trying real hard to change the narratives of the old ego into self-embraced narrative, really trying. It was very touching. I mean, even though it's it moves the heart.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying, and you know, you believe it. I'm trying really hard.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that shit. I believe I'm the evil one. But I'm trying real hard to get the shit.
Yeah. That other moment, too, he says, I want to buy your life.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
And it's got quality. It's got, we know. I was going to ask you, where is Eros' voice? And I think that's one of the places. Why would I say Eros' voice is there? Her voice is there. Is her voice there? Why is the voice of Eros there?
Because his life is important.
And there,
and it's redemptive.
It's redemptive, and there's compassion. He's co-suffering. My guess is, in his ego narratives, he's doing, I love that, he's doing history. He's doing anamnesis. I think he's awakening to his true history. He sees himself 20 years earlier. He's just seeing himself. And he knows this kid's trying real hard and doesn't even know it yet. He recognizes, and there's a compassion, there's an ability which literally means the ability to co-suffer with others. It's a voice of their own. Or we can talk more about a voice. Then even a place with a self role. That's a great place. I'm trying to work. Do we see the self in the other one?
Well, I think that just, you know, being that is the self or the alchemical process always demands being the seeker, always existentially questioning. I think that was really interesting because the two films you've shown, I think Edward Edinger in one of his books said the greatest difficulty in working with the polarities is the good and evil polarity. And so just the way he's questioning that from every angle is to me what's very fascinating here.
That's right. You could be the evil one,
mm-hmm.
and I could be the good shepherd. The gun here could be the.
Ego has to separate from the kind of primary. In fact, that's what I wanted to say. This is one way to talk about object. I'm going to show you the same kind of concepts in a different model, an object-relational model. This is what I call projective. I'm just doing it to help you see a little bit of your experience in these forms. This is what I experience when I work with people in my own life from an object relational perspective informed by depth psychology. We all had an original experience of empathically appropriate empowerment. That happened to very few of us, where we got appropriate empathic empowerment from our primal parents. Most of us had abuse and humiliation by the primal parents. It was the primal wounding biologically. Usually 18 to 36 months. It's okay when we're fused with the great mother and the great... But if you've got narcissistically disturbed, self-damaged parents who are very anxious about their own psychological self-esteem and have gotten wrapped up in having this nearing child that reflects their own grandiosity, and suddenly about 18 months this little kid starts scooting away from them, and it stirs up their own sense of abandonment and emptiness and panic that there's nothing in the world. All it was this fused relationship with this child. Usually then your steps in individuation and freedom, subtly and sometimes overtly, will be punished by subtle or overt threats. I will either kill you if you keep doing this, or I will abandon you. That's a primal threat. It's done over and over again, all sorts of micro-operations. And that's the primal wound. It's a big move in Jungian psychology now that's British-inspired from Tavistock and Ridge, reclining thing of infant observation. To your infant observation groups. What that's supposed to do is to awaken inside analysts a deep primary appreciation of how this happens. It's just not a concept. And apparently, it's quite, I've never done it, seen some videos, it's quite horrifying. You contract with a birth couple and watch them for 2 years, and you see this thing happen. You watch them a week or two, or just observe for a week or two, and you can't intervene unless it's overt abuse, because you get some observing. People are horrified to see that this really happens. It really is a phenomenon. It's not intended. But you have, it's a deep compassion for our clients. You know, Freud discovered all this thing through a retrofit from adult analysis regrading back through their conscious fantasies, and Jung did a lot of that. And Klein and Mahler and a lot of analysts said, well, why don't we just look at real babies and look at real infant stuff and see what happens? My God, it happens. The primal wound happens. 90% of us in this room have that primal wound. It stamps it. The crystallization of this experience within the psyche is called introjection. Last night, it is this thing inside Ripley's body. You know, I was thinking last night going to bed, so I wondered if the director was clever enough, if Ridley Scott was. You know who the great British alchemist's name was? It's George Ripley. And I was just wondering, I was going to sleep, I was like, that couldn't be. Because I was drifting off it. Did you ever know? I love the big thing to research. I was wondering, because these names often are very carefully chosen inside the scripts, and I wondered. But interject, it is this monster, and... what we do with this, we interject those of you who know object relations theory. It gets physical. People, a lot of physical symptoms are related to the fact we make the body a toxic dump. The spirit and soul separate. It makes sense in that integer model. And we split off the dark stuff that soul and spirit cannot bear, the evil, the darkness. It splits off and organically takes residence inside the body. I'm absolutely convinced that people have recurrent symptoms, chronic recurrent symptoms. It's the living psychic determinant. The body is a psychic dump for these toxic waste of child. Because an interjection and object relations have another word is wonderful. It is split off. The unbearable aspect of that is split off. And it's reposited deep in the unconscious, inside the body. And so there's not a conscious union mentalist here. It's not a conscious separation, it's an unconscious operation split away. Outside, out of mind, dump it in the body, the body. Well, just like the earth, everything toxic is rolling into the body. We'll seal the dump with clay and old bottles. Then there is a ceaseless search, because it's as hot, it's burning in this. A ceaseless search for a safe place and persons within which to dump, through projection, these feared or toxic corrosive wastes and re-experience the respectful, adoring primal parent one's innocence originally sought and deserved. We do that when we first find our peers. We try to project this onto them. My good friends and my bad friends. The safe friends, the unsafe friends. We do that in schooling, in churching, in ganging, in clubbing, in lodging. And most importantly, we do it in dating. The transference of these toxic wastes and the remedial redemptive expectations is projection. That's what projection means.
Is there a reason, this is terrible to say, but is there a reason why you didn't put marriage on there? Are you dating the implication of long-term?
Well, that's exactly. Marriage is the classic example. Dating and bonding. Marriage is the classic. And I talked a little bit about it in a joke last night about it. But Gibson's 30-second rule. That all of that projective drama is dumped in the first 30 seconds. You carry all my toxic waste and keep it safely away from me. And you also give me the respectful, adoring, primal parenting my innocence originally. I mean, no human being can carry that load. But think about it. Think about your primary love in your life experience and realize how much you projected on them and projected onto you. And of course, the minute that that breaks down, then the split off rage, oh crap, you are just lying. That original abusive primal pyramid. And of course, when I give people analysis, it's helping them pull those projections back. That's the classic example.
Is this from Edinger?
This is Gibson. This is my experience, but it's the same. You can see what he's talking about in psychological, about how the uniumen palace can consciously be used in this process of pulling your projections back. The activation of these transferred wastes for the purpose of study and reassurance has a thing called projective identification. It really works. I've got this hot stuff. We're married. I'm going to throw this on you. I find out you're not the primal restoring parent that's going to give me my innocence back. You're just the jughead like my mother and my father. And you're just, in fact, you may even be worse. But I know your buttons, and I'm going to drive you crazy, and I'm going to get this hot stuff in you. I'm going to get you to identify with it so that I can study it and see if I can figure this out. And couples will tell you, I'm a perfectly nice person with anybody else. I get with my wife, and I turn into another person. I get with my husband, and he can make me a scream. I don't recognize this person. Well, of course they don't. It's the husband's rage. They're acting out for him. For the purposes of study, ultimately, what you want to do is activate this other person. You want to study it so that eventually you can reabsorb, digest, and have a depth synthesis of that. That's transformation. You pull it back. So my spouse, what you are, you're my soror mystica. You act this stuff out for me. Let me see how I can study it and get in touch with it. And then you won't have to carry it for me. Someday I'm really hoping in my heart of hearts I can bring it back home. And I can bring the unio mentalis back in connection with the body in a conscious way. I can transform that, be a whole person, and then even open to the unus nunus, the one that lives beyond. Now that's a hard process. Couples can do all three of the first stages really easy in this culture. They can be primarily limited. We don't have any choice in that. They can project real easily. They can activate this stuff in their spouse. We can't, without any help, without a tivanos, pull the stuff back. Without help, without a container, without a listening other, without a compassionate present other. Our narrator today in Pulp Fiction knew how to do the first three stages of that great, but what he wanted to do was to try. He was doing this wonderful, final transforming stage. I'm going to try real hard to pull back all the evil and projecting onto you and recognize you are not a bad, deluded motherfucker. You are a hurting little kid like me that needed a father and mother. I'm trying real hard to not project that. I'm trying real hard to get the unio mentalis connected back to the body. I'm trying real hard to be a whole person. That's how it works. And analysis is little micro experiences of projection, reprojection, projective identification, and transformation, pulling projection. That's the alchemical stuff. Staring into the retort, projecting all of our fantasies that can hurt into that, and pulling it back into the retort inside our own experience. That's what the process is. So, with that in mind, you in for a treat. This is the consummative set of images out of Andrei Rublev, who is the great iconographer of Russian history. Many of you seen, or icon lovers, the most beautiful icons ever created were by Andrei Rublev. One of the most famous Trinities is by Rublev. It's probably the one icon most of you probably most seen in the Trinity is a Rublev. It's a untold books. And Andrei Tarkovsky, the great Russian film director, eventually became an exile. Wonderful cinematographer. Created this book out of love, carried this film out of love. And it's just out now. Go and see the whole thing. See it. It's an extraordinary set of images. Andrei, A-N-D-R-E-I, Rublev, R-U-B-L-E-V, and the director is Andrei, A-N-D-R-E-I, Tarkovsky, T-A-R-K-O-V-S-K-Y. Two of his films I love, like The Sacrifice and then Andrei Rublev. The first film is part of the film's loving homage to the struggle of Rublev, where he decides out of great pain, and he sees the Tatar raves, and there's this little mute peasant woman again, who I think is the mute voice of what would you think that was going to be? Of Aaron. Yes. She's the mute voice because she's not yet found her voice. And he sees all his raids and pillages and says he will not create any beauty, he will do no more icons. He refuses to create. That's the first act of the film. The only thing he gets connected is this wonderful new child. And then she runs off because of her childlike and unsafe projections onto these even tougher. She runs off with him and he loses her. It's a separation again from his own eros and his own out. You can see a lot of levels. But it's a separation. And he takes about silent. The second half of the film is a wonderful thing. And only briefly does Rublev know he's a monk, a silent monk that appears in, you'll see him as a shrouded monk figure that appears in different scenes here, crossing the life of this 13-year-old boy who is the son of a famous bellmaker who's taken away by the plague. The whole village is wiped out, and the prince wants to make the most wonderful, pure-sounding bell the world has ever seen. So he rides up with all his goons to go take off the bellmaker. The 13-year-old kid seeing an opportunity says, "Wait a minute, I can do it." You're only 13.
Yeah. But just before he died, my dad told me that secret.
Friends will have our fights and bring the kill one. Great one. Bring the kid. And then the whole film is about him leading this 13-year-old, leading all his men. Suddenly he realizes he's really got himself in a fight. But then all of a sudden, he gets transformed by that. This kid's involved. He's just a mystical prince about this. And so what, the first parts are about finding just the right play. And part of him is a subtle little pubescent kid. And they say, well, why not this play? Well, he says, no, no. But he really does know something. And in the rainstorm is saddest as he falls down a hill and finds just the white clay. Because they build this huge pit and go in the ground. This thing will dig this huge hole in the ground. And they got a line of rock and just the white clay. And then we're getting ready now. What you will see is the scene where they're getting ready for the fire. We'll carry all of the room. We have a third one, the sequence of images. It's a closing meditation, and we'll talk about it. The transformation process. That should give you enough setup about what we're seeing.
Eject. And it's captioned. It ought to be fairly easy to read, but feel free to adjust it.
Star phenomenon, in my experience, results from that magical moment. It is indeed magical. Of deep, affective, and imaginal connection. When the ego first consciously and fully experiences the touch of the self. The sound of the bell, the touch of the deep self-father, and does not freeze or withdraw, but paradoxically, against all of the rational of its defenses, against previous unutterable sufferings. The defenses, projected defenses, I will no longer bear this, I will keep this pain away from me, profoundly surrenders to this divine embrace. Well, I think that's what's going on here. He was surrendering to the self, and it was a deep sorrowful agony, and at the other, it was an ecstatic agony. It was a surrender to the container of the self and the divine belt.
And ecstasy.
It was ecstasis. Ecstasis in the ancient Greek sense is that carrying the opposite tensions of light and dark and male and female, joy and suffering.
And being outside of
yourself. Outside of oneself, into the great macrocosm, thrown into the self.
Well, I was thinking too, the image that was so strong to me is the bell ringer. The camera showing just this bell ringer coming.
The sounds, Tarkovsky's brilliance in the sound of the ropes, our ego agony in this world, pulling up the bell. I mean, it gets into the deep levels of it, and our efforts to want to get it through. And then all these critics over here. All these kind of archon voices, piece of shit, peasants, they're stupid. All of our discounting voices, they're all there. But the sound of the struggle, the ropes, and the work on the bell.
But I see it too about the opposites that you were just talking about. So that, you know, it's in this
tension.
Yes. And that means.
Oh, I can't produce anything but shit. That's what I was always told. It's not going to rain. I mean, it's the great thing. I'll be annihilated. I mean, that's the primal fear. We're finally, it's going to catch up with me.
Like if I am a thought in my work or in this relationship, and I will be annihilated or abandoned. It's the primal and sensual world we all fear. And all of those qualities of Eros I showed up last night, the ancient Greek thing, all of the qualities are in there, the light and the dark, the silence, all of those qualities are her voice. When he's closed, Tarkovsky, there are directors and then there are gods, and Tarkovsky thinks it's a god. What? And he did that in Soviet Union under all that. And of course you can see, he's treaded on black ice with all that religious thing, but you can see where they like the celebration of the common man against it. But he really went on black ice with all of this Eros. But artists can do those sort of things.
The great tyranny of His Excellency, who demands of people whom he believes cannot do it, to do something perfect.
Projects it onto the common. Yeah. And if you don't, which I don't think you are, because you're just peculiar dumb people, I'll take your heads off. Projects all his own rage. And his own, and of course, the thing, royalty sitting on feet of clay, he's got his own primal movement. He's projected, he can't get any more, can't get any closer.
I was struck with the image of the fire of the boy's feet. Having discovered the divine ecstasy for himself and to the obligation of being able to have this power for God. When you discover the power of God, you discover fire.
And what an alchemical is, there's the calcination of the embers and the ash from the fire, this transformative fire of ego really burning through the self. And of course, you know, we don't have to talk about it. Aristotle's alchemical world was all there, earth, air, fire, water, and pit, it was all there. And voice, dry, hot, and cold, it was all there. It was just all, maybe with all the alchemical four, the four functions and the four elements were all down in the pit, and it's cooking.
That's the silence of it. The
solutio,
paper coming out,
come up out of sublimatio,
the rain,
and the coagulatio. It's all the alchemical, the whole opus is there in this image, and the transformation on the soul of an ego. An ego undergoing an initiatory event, so it's a pubescent age four. The very thing our culture doesn't have. And all we discover is the missing body was in the grave was really there in the nude room. He was watching. You know what you saw the images? Of watching from above the pit. The watching of his heart. And was there at the right moment of thought. That's what's so touching for us. And broke his vow of silence. And he says, yeah, now I go paint. I have a reason. Love for this boy. And love for the son of that bell. He got back in touch with now could go create Eros is reached through the sacrifices of this war. It's a very touching set of image. Who redeems who in this world? Yes. We redeem each other.
The
bell still redeems again.
The bell that descends and then
comes back up, descends, and it's coming up from the bowels of the earth where it's been cooked. How can it put a sound? God, it's amazing.
Well, just since you gave the bell out of the air.
And I think, I don't know, I've seen this three times now, I think the beautiful woman they see, I think it's the new woman in turn. I think that's who she is in her Berber outfit now. The beautiful, I think that is her, the return there, she returns.
And the movement too is that they see her and then she stands beside a crown.
All the seas, it's just... So, and my guess is that Tarkovsky painted in his heart. This is so intuitive in his heart. I've done a lot of this as character. Mise en scène, I wrote all of this, came out of his heart. But my gosh, the sound of it so bad. Imagine what that sounds like. Isn't it? They probably had to fire a real bell doing the little concert. It must have been incredible moving that he used to do the bellows. He used to call alchemists puffers because the bellows. And the bellows had to puff up the water. It was the puffing bellows.
Don't you really, two movies here or one?
It's one movie. It's one movie.
It's called
Andrei Rublev.
That's what it's called.
That's the title of the film. Mm-hmm. And this is a historical figure, of course, brought back to us in the policy of Tarkovsky's
part. I'm struck by the contrast with another film that's playing at the moment at the Tacoma Art Museum. Is an exhibit of Rodin's work. And downstairs, there's a 15-minute or 55-minute film about the final casting of The Gates of Hell, which really was Rodin's life work. And it was in 1980 that it finally actually got cast in bronze. And the man who did the casting had this idea that it would only be cast in two very large pieces.
which had never been done, and there's marvelous lead up to how this is, it's never been done, you know, the biggest single blah 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 blah, and you can tell if the metal starts coming out of these little apertures, then you'll know it's really gone everywhere and stuff, and all that happens. It all takes all day and all night and much longer than expected, and the fire isn't high enough, and they can't be pure and just have wood, they have to add coal. It's very dramatic, and it fails. It was too large. And so the wax couldn't hold the process in the middle. And as soon as the hot metal hit it, it collapsed. So parts of it are perfect and parts of it are just this very strange thing. And so they had to redo it in smaller pieces
and
patiently assemble it and weld it. And you're not prepared for that. But it's very interesting thing.
And ask the alchemist, the opus, the successful opus is born on the back of 1,000 unsuccessful ones. Do we all know the truth of that? Or anyone in this room that doesn't know the truth of that?
I love that film for that reason, that there's all this buildup about, this is going to be the first time, this is the biggest, it's almost an American film, it's the biggest one in the world. And then it doesn't work. And it's very quiet in the film, how the rest of it happens.
Yes. Well, it's interesting that the film was shot in black and white, and so it had
all the way through. The only color is pink.
There's the reddening, the
rubedo,
and
yellowing. There's castanaccio in it. There's not much albedo in it. But I never thought about it. The colors, even.
Yeah.
And you know what those are? That's the monastery. He went. That's the Trinity Monastery. Those are pictures. But that was the product of ringing the bell. Those are the great images. And you've seen some of those. It's a classic, particularly feminine figures. It's just so well. That's fair.
There's one spot where there's the albedo just wiped out.
Oh, that's right. That's right. And of course, they kept featuring both the feminine figures and the dominant, of course, the grail cup, the essence cup, kept coming back up. The cup of the alchemical essence. And you love the feet, the innovation, almost the catalyst of the Sephirotic tree, the human being, the mystical person. The feet was really beginning. And then there's the cup header. Very. And then closing, all the way through, there are horses, usually stumbling and awkward or being abused, and at the end, these three horses. But of course, you know, what is that? So, I think it's the free, unrestrained, instinctual eros back from the walls, the saddest image.
And moisture.
And moisture. Come on. Down, the voice.
You should probably close with whatever you're doing.
One of the books I had last night, and I'll put that bibliography up again, Noel Cobb, Archetypal Imagination, his lead essay in this, interestingly enough, he and I apparently danced in the same film. It's a lead essay about this film. So if you would like to see a reflection, I just discovered this in August, and this is wonderful. Well, listen to his reverie about the bell. The bell connects downwards into the physical realm through its resonance, its power to set things ringing, round as a belly. The bell seems pregnant with new life, ringing in the birth of the new year as it rings for the resurrected Christos. A bell rattle may be a baby's first toy, tool of communication and musical instrument, but its hollow, cavernous shape with a free-swinging clapper is most of all an image of the voice, open mouth, and visible tongue. Not from the mouth of a cultured, articulate order, but rather from the wide-open gape of a bellowing, booming being, bringing forth the utterance of some pure, primal, original sound. Bim, boom. In the beginning was the word. The bell tolls or tells the story of mortality. Not only does it tell the time striking the passing hours, but it rings out the old year and funerally intones for another passing citizen. Traditionally, it was what was called the community together for prayer, for weddings, for sacred celebrations. The bell as mediator, as angelos, a voice of imagination, calling us to the word to wake up to the world, the unknown. The bell is memoria. Vast storehouse of memory images, the Akashic archives of Manasseh Nebi. Great memory, mother of the muses, does that ring any bells? Not to forget the bell's alarm, warning, gong of unattended dangers, fires, hidden reefs, prowlers, fools, thieves, and lepers, but also the bell that says all's well. The cowbell, the church bell, the dinner bell, the sleigh bell, the loved and dreaded knell, summoning us to heaven or hell.
bell binder, bell rose, blue bells, canterbury bells, flower bells of toil, and the toil soundlessly in the wind. It's a wonderful kind of image of the bell toil.
I would put up, this is being out here. Maybe actually do have to, so I'm thinking back to thinking of blue. Okay.
All right.
We need to.
Okay. Yeah.
But that's good. We got practice about.
All right, very good. After last night, I'm alarmed. I mean, I thought he was going to go through all the security guards after a while.
Speaking of
bells,
yeah,
it hurts. Like to close with some bibliography of both the one I had last night and the more extended sheet. People are always asking, some of you were not here last night, so again, Noel Kopp, I just read that. Excellent. It's a wonderful set of images. Alchemical and imaginal. The Kulian is much more of a scholarship thing, but if you're interested about this Ars Memoriam, Magic in the Renaissance, the Chino and the whole crowd who invented this. Thomas More does a lot of writing, but the Eros and Magic in the Renaissance is a good read. It's well worth struggling through if you're interested in that. Edinger, I've been mentioning a lot, his Mysterium lectures. Those were a series of lectures to find somebody taped. He's also got a great series of lectures on tape for the LA Library on the Greek philosophers, which I hope gets published. Somebody does the same thing. It's a wonderful collection. He's one of the senior analysts now. He's just pouring on him. And there are analysts that come on. I have a feeling he's pouring out the decades of work in him in the LA room and wrapping it up. You get a feeling of a man wrapping up his stuff reads so resonant when this is coming out of him. He's one of the hottest and most grounded voices in the LA world. It's just pouring out of him off the press. Marilyn Nagy, Philosophical Issues in Psychology, CGU. I know it's a hardback. I have it in paper, too. There's a paper version. It may not still be, but it's available. And Jeanette Paris's thing on Pagan Grace, Dionysus, Hermes, and the Goddess Memory in Daily Life is a wonderful thing from spring. Jim Melvin's publishing house. And a little bit more extended on Eros and Gnosticism and some of my, kind of looking in here, some of my favorite in there. Aldo Caratanuto, the Italian analyst, Eros and Pathos, Shade of Love and Suffering is a really fun read. Classic, you have to, I think it's been reprinted, but you can get it at the University of Washington Library, the Spring Series. This Henry Corbin, who is a scholar of Persian literature and mysticism, The Moonless Imaginalis of the Imaginary and the Imaginal, was the seminal essay that started our type of psychology along with Jim Hillman's work in the last 20 years. If you're interested in this whole idea about Eros and the Imaginal, that essay was a beginning piece, and it's very fun reading. It's worth getting a copy of it if you're taken off by it, excited about that. Lawrence Jaffe, that 1989 volume, to my way, is the best Jungian look at kind of the impact of our field on comparative religion and comparative religion on us. It's filled with eros and love and respect and well-founded in Jungian thought. So it's one of the clearest bells of the volume that we have in Jungian literature. I really like that kind of volume a lot. Of course, Thomas More's Care of the Soul and Soulmates are classics. The Planets Within, some people are interested about alchemical connections to astronomy. His book on the Planets Within is a great read on there. A lot of information about how Pacino got into reverie of the heart and worked with planetary astrology and alchemy in the Renaissance. And of course, Pacino had profound effects on Botticelli, Leonardo da Vinci, and on the Medici family, Cosimo the Elder, and Lorenzo the Magnificent were deeply influenced by him. Was quite a. I think he was the original Jungian analyst. He was the philosopher of the court in Florence, and he was a Platonic scholar, and his heart was just filled with love for Eros, and he deepened this idea about memoria, what we now call acute imagination, a central analytic technique of taking images and reading yourself into these images and trying very hard. He took ancient technique and gave it a modern face. And Thomas More writes about that with a lot of love. Robert Savello's little Facing the World of Souls is a great little volume. One of my favorites. Margaret Starbird, she's a Tacoma woman. It's a really interesting thing about Mary Magdalene as an image. And I think in my language of Eros across the life cycle, it's a nice read. And Robert Stein, it's an old volume, but Incest in Human Love is a good read. Because think about Jungian psychology. Jung wrote, you know, the book he wrote, The Psychology of the Conscious, that he split with Freud from, was over this issue about incest. And our culture gets it confused. There's bad incest, where mothers or fathers inappropriately violate boundaries with their young. There's unavoidable and healthy incest, where every little boy needs to know, most often his mother finds him sensually and spiritually attractive, and every little girl needs to know that about her father. And that gets, we don't know how to mediate appropriate incest in this culture. Imaginal incest. And Stein's volume is a wonderful kind of union exploration of those things. I'd like to close with an experience, and then I'll be really happy to stay here and just interact with you all, but as a kind of a closing contemplation, right? I wanted to just hear Eros's voice. The best way I could think of to do kind of end our time together is Bobby McFerrin and his group redid the 23rd Psalm. And it's quite effective. Here's this ancient, probably a 2,500-year-old piece of mystical literature. It's common to Islam. Nothing like this common to Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, great mystical traditions, and they've all had mystical reflections and meditations and musings about this text. But he recasts it, and I think how he recasts it, he gives Eros's voice and clear feel through it. So we just close with that, and then any kind of questions, and we'll be gone. And it deals about death into life.
The Lord is my shepherd. I have all I need. She makes me lie down in green meadows, beside the still waters she will lead. She restores my soul. She rights my wrongs. She leads me in a path of good things and fills my heart with songs. Even though
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.